Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian.
In this hour, we explore how a little-known international bank influences the world's economy. Then, scholars analyze the role of comedy in politics. Switzerland is home to a little-known international bank. It's not an ordinary bank, but rather a bank for bankers. Our next guest says it has enormous influence over economies. Adam Labor joins us now. He's a journalist and the author of Tower of Basel, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World. Welcome, Adam Labor. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Why don't you start us with an explanation about what exactly this bank is? It's called the Bank of Settlements. Why is it called that, and what exactly does it do?
Well, the Bank for International Settlements was originally founded in 1930. To manage German reparations payments for the First World War. That means the monies that the victorious Allies, including the United States, decided the Germans had to pay for their role in the First World War. But by 1932, Germany wasn't paying German reparations payments anymore, but the bank was still there, and it's still there now. And the real reason it was founded was to have a place for central bankers to meet, away from nosy politicians and prying reporters. And the bank was founded by an international treaty, which means that it's the only commercial bank in the world. It's a profit-making organization, but it also has the same status as the United Nations or an embassy, so it's almost extraterritorial. The Swiss authorities have no right to enter the bank's headquarters in Basel, for example, without the permission of the management.
So who gets the profits?
The bank keeps some of its profits and pays out some of its profits to its shareholders, who are its member banks, the 60-member central banks. That includes, for example, the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, the Bank of Italy, France, Bundesbank, and so on. But what's really interesting about it nowadays is that every 2 months, all the central bankers of the world meet there in conditions of some secrecy. For example, no journalists are even allowed in the building for those 2 days while those meetings go on. And they talk about monetary policy, which means how the bank, the central bank or the Federal Reserve governs the money supply and helps kind of decide the value of money. So the discussions that they have there are very relevant to us because they get ideas from each other, they exchange ideas with each other, talk about different policies, how to implement them. The bank's been very important during the recent crisis. But we don't know anything about these discussions. They're all top secret.
So in essence, what you're saying is this is a quasi-public institution in a way because it's created by international treaty. It's supposed to have some sort of public purpose, but it has no public oversight.
Exactly. Yeah, you've got it in one. The people that work there in the bank itself says it has a kind of mission of public service to serve central banks. But it doesn't really have any oversight. I mean, the oversight is, in a sense, I guess, the shareholders, same as in any commercial organization. But the shareholders are the people who set the bank up for their own interests. So it sort of goes round in a circle. And as I say in the book, when they set the bank up, they launch the bank with the capital. The central banks put the money in to have the share capital. Then they buy the shares. And then it makes a profit very quickly because everyone wants to do business with the Bank for International Settlements because its shareholders are central banks. You know, it's never going to go bust, really, or it's highly unlikely. You know, it has a AAA gold, triple plus credit rating nowadays. You know, I mean, exaggerating, but, you know, the top class credit rating. So it's a perpetual money machine, but it has no real democratic or meaningful oversight.
Is that very different from, say, its member banks like the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England? Don't they also have a great deal of secrecy around them?
Well, they have some secrecy about their operations, and I understand that they need to have some secrecy because if Ben Bernanke said that he's going to do this with interest rates or do that with interest rates in a globalized instant response economy, that information, you know, if someone knew that before it was public, would be worth a lot of money because you could, you know, long and short the dollar and do all sorts of things. But the point is that the governor of the Bank of England, you know, is accountable to the British government, and they're acting in a way, you know, in coordination, although they're independent. They're obviously kind of in touch and discussing and coordinating things, you know, with the US Treasury and with the Chancellor of the Exchequer in Britain, whereas the BIS just goes off on its own. I mean, it doesn't organize big interventions in the markets to raise interest rates up and down and that kind of thing. But what it does do is act as a meeting point. And my point is that we need to know a bit more information about these meetings, because we don't know who attends, we don't know what's discussed, and we don't know the themes of those discussions. Now, the bankers say, oh, you know, if you put a camera in the room or you issued a transcript, then nobody would say anything because they didn't want to say things on the record. You know, they sort of present a ridiculous scenario as to why nothing can be done. And I say, look, I understand that you need to have some confidentiality. Of course you do. But also, you know, we are paying you. A central banker is not working for JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs. He's a public servant. And we want to know where you are. We want to know who goes to these meetings. And we want to know the broad themes of the discussion of those meetings.
Now, you listed in your book several countries that are actually engaged in the meetings. What countries are excluded? And then there's also these countries that can observe but can't speak. How does all that work?
Well, it's very hierarchical, probably partly because the bank is based in Switzerland and has been there since 1930, so it's taken on, you know, the Swiss love of order and culture and hierarchy and secrecy. So what happens is the meetings take place every 2 months. The bank has 60 member banks. Well, the 60 central bankers all land in Zurich Airport, and they're brought by a fleet of limousines to Basel, and they obviously stay in a five-star hotel. And during the week, you know, they usually arrive on a Saturday or Sunday, maybe stay till Monday night or the Tuesday morning. And during that time, they're all very, very well looked after with wonderful food and the finest wines and so on and so forth. So the most important meeting is on the Sunday night. That's called the Economic Consultative Meeting. And that's the board of directors of the bank, which is, you know, the governors of the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the Bank of France, the Bank of Italy, plus the general manager of the bank, plus the governors of India, the national banks of India and Brazil. And so there's 18 or so of them. And the next day, there's something called the Global Economy Meeting. 30 countries attend that. And that's bigger countries like Turkey and Indonesia, for example, attend that. And then another 15 or so countries, sort of middle-sized countries, like, for example, Hungary and Poland, I think, can attend but don't really speak. But and then the last 15 aren't even allowed to attend. They just have to hang around outside, very small countries like Slovakia and Slovenia. But what's interesting is that after 1989 and the collapse of communism, all these tiny countries like Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania and Slovakia and Slovenia, they're all let in, you know, and their total population is like 16 million people. But Pakistan is not a member of the BIS, you know, with 180 million people. In Africa, only Algeria and South Africa are members. Nigeria is not a member of the BIS. Kazakhstan is not a member of the BIS. It's still very Eurocentric.
And what's the justification for that?
Well, they say governance. The BIS demands certain standards of governance and obviously transparency in the way the central banks run and the way the country is run. But, you know, there's China and Russia and Saudi Arabia are members of the BIS, and there's all sorts of questions you can raise about, you know, transparency and economic governance in China and Russia, for example. So, you know, it's still a very Eurocentric, perhaps we could even speak frankly and say it's a very kind of white-dominated organization.
Well, let's back up to the root of the BIS. And at the root of it was a man named Montagu Norman. Who was he?
Well, the bank was set up essentially by Montagu Norman, who was the governor of the Bank of England from 1920 to 1944, and Hjalmar Schacht, who was the president of the Reichsbank, which was the central bank of Germany. And during the 1930s, Schacht was an extremely important figure. He continued serving under Hitler, and then he became the Minister of Economics. And he was generally regarded as the man, you know, who constructed the so-called, you know, first German economic miracle, bringing people in from unemployment and getting Germany back on the road after the devastation of the First World War, and essentially building the Nazi war machine, and was indeed put on trial in Nuremberg after the Second World War for being the financial genius behind the Nazi empire, which he was. And then he was acquitted, oddly enough.
Now, that wasn't Montagu Norman, that was Schacht, right?
Yeah, sorry, that was Schacht, but Norman was the governor of the Bank of England from 1920 to 1944. He's extremely close to Schacht, and that relationship was really the relationship that built up the bank. I mean, Schacht used to call the bank my bank, and Norman was one of the very first people to help set it up.
Now, Norman was thought to have been rebuilding Europe, creating financial cooperation. He thought that would be beneficial for the world. Do you have a sense of his philosophy and his plan and how it was materialized?
Well, yes. You know, there is an argument. There is a case for the defense. I mean, the people like Schacht and Norman think that, you know, stupid politicians get us into war, and what we really need to do is just do lots of business and keep the money flowing. This was the kind of the start of the financial globalization that you see nowadays, that, you know, a lot of money is sloshing around. The BIS helped organize bailouts for Spain and Hungary and Austria when some of the banks were in trouble. So this is the start of it. But at the same time, there's a real arrogance that goes with that. We know what's best. You silly politicians and little people, you don't know anything. Just leave it to us and we'll organize things. So what you end up with is this sense of kind of celestial mission. And I think, you know, I use the word arrogance, and I think it's correct. You know, for example, in March 1939, Nazi Germany invaded Czechoslovakia. And SS officers marched over to the governor of the National Bank in Prague, the Czechoslovak National Bank, and said, you've got 23 tons of gold in the BIS, actually held in the BIS subaccount of the Bank of England. You know, the gold wasn't physically in Prague, it was physically in London, but it was credited to the BIS. And they say, we want it. You send an order to London and to Basel saying, transfer this gold to the subaccount of the Reichsbank. So obviously, I mean, they've literally got Lugers pointed at their heads. They send the order. And what happens, it's crystal clear that any order coming from Prague to say send 23 tons of our gold to Nazi Germany after Nazi Germany is invaded is going to be issued under duress. But Norman was absolutely instrumental in making sure that that money was transferred to Nazi Germany. And the BIS just said, oh, well, you know, the paperwork's in order. I mean, they hummed and hawed a bit, but they essentially took the position that the paperwork's in order. And off the gold went without a shot being fired. So, you know, there's this sense that, you know, we, the bankers, know what's best, and we have to keep the channels open and move the money around. And it doesn't really matter if there's two SS officers standing behind someone pointing a gun at them. We just follow the paperwork.
One of the interesting things about this gentleman, Schacht, that you have been writing about is that even while he was propping up Nazi Germany, he did not necessarily agree with the Nazi philosophy.
No, he wasn't a believing Nazi, you know, kind of strutting around like an SS officer. He was an old-fashioned German nationalist and an authoritarian. He wasn't a liberal democrat, but he wasn't a believer in all the Nazis' theories of racial supremacy. And he had Jewish friends. I mean, some of his best friends really were Jewish. But he, like many people, thought that Hitler was, you know, was rather unsavory and unpleasant and not ideal. But he was the best option to save Germany, because at that time in Europe, people were very worried about the rise of communism and the Soviet Union. And Germany almost had a civil war and a kind of revolution, and the Weimar Republic collapsed. And they said, we need order and stability. And Hitler's rather ghastly, but we'll hold our nose and we'll go with him. In Schacht's defense, eventually he broke with him. And in 1944, he was actually sent to Dachau, a concentration camp where he was, and he was moved around various concentration camps and was eventually liberated by the Allies.
He was not found guilty of war crimes, but did some of the BIS directors get charged? You noted that there were five that were charged. Were any convicted?
Yes, five BIS directors were charged, and the five were Schacht himself, Hermann Schmitz, who was the boss of a company called IG Farben, which was the biggest Nazi industrial and chemical conglomerate, which ran its own corporate concentration camp at Auschwitz and also manufactured Zyklon B, the gas used to murder the Jews. He was found guilty, and he got a very short sentence, I think 3 or 4 years, of which he served very little. A German private banker called Kurt von Schroeder was put on trial, who was a BIS board member. And the president, Schacht's successor as the president of the Reichsbank, Walter Funk, and his deputy, Emil Poole, also a BIS director. They were both put on trial, and they were found guilty. But all of these people served quite short sentences, and many of them were released, thanks in large part to John McCloy, who was the governor of Germany, and Alan Dulles, who pushed very, very hard behind the scenes for German industrialists to serve token sentences and then be released to rebuild the German economy as a bulwark against the Soviet Union.
Let's go back to Alan Dulles, because you had quite a bit in your book, Tower of Basel, about him. First of all, how would you describe Alan Dulles, and what would you say his whole role in this bank was, including this era with Nazi Germany?
Well, Dulles is a very fascinating figure. Alan Dulles and his brother, John Foster Dulles, were really key figures in the 1930s of the money channel that ran between Wall Street and Berlin. Now, they were both lawyers for Sullivan and Cromwell, which had an enormous amount of clients in Germany, from private companies to, you know, they were working with various merchant banks and investment banks in the States, you know, doing the deals and funneling money to, you know, municipalities to rebuild trams and to commercial investments. And there was nothing illegal in this. And lots of, you know, British banks and French banks where people were trading with Germany. But during the war, Dulles was very close friends with Thomas McKittrick, who is the American banker who was the president of the BIS from 1940 to 46. And McKittrick and also a man called Roger Aubois, who was the bank's general manager, were both assets of Alan Dulles. I think McKittrick was, you know, code number 644 and Aubois was 650. And they were in very close touch. McKittrick was close friends with Dulles. I found some very interesting documents in the archives of the Office for Strategic Services that show how McKittrick in 1944 was in contact with German industrialists. And what he's saying to them is that, you know, cooperate with us and don't make trouble, essentially, when we invade. You know, the war's over. But be helpful to us and we'll make sure, this is in print, in writing, that we will guarantee your profits after the Second World War and we won't decartelize you, because there was pressure at the time to break up, you know, these giant conglomerates, you know, big German firms that were very much part of the whole Nazi war machine. And the shocking thing is that this isn't some kind of wild personal initiative of McKittrick or Dulles. All this is taking place with the full knowledge of the State Department and the Office of Strategic Services. Which is why Harry Dexter White and Henry Morgenthau hated the BIS and wanted it closed down. And they were kind of fighting with McKittrick and Dulles over this. And Harry Dexter White said, you know, while our boys are fighting the Germans, McKittrick's doing business with the Germans. And it's completely true. And during the Second World War, the BIS accepted a lot of looted Nazi gold from Germany and also did a lot of foreign exchange deals for them. The BIS was so useful to Nazi Germany that it was described by Emil Poole, who was the vice president of the Nazi Reichsbank and a BIS director, as the only real foreign branch of the Reichsbank. So the only real foreign branch of the Reichsbank had an American president.
It's quite fascinating, isn't it?
It really is, and it's actually quite shocking.
Quite shocking.
We know what happened at D-Day and at the Battle of the Bulge and at Arnhem and how many American and Allied soldiers were killed. And while this was going on, this incredible cynicism of, you know, yeah, well, whatever, let's keep the money connections open.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Scholar's Circle and we're speaking with Adam Labore about his book, Tower of Basel. Let's talk for a bit about where this bank is located. It was initially behind a chocolate shop. Unnoticeable.
Yes, it was set up. It was very Swiss and very 1930s. It was set up in a former hotel, the Grand Hotel Savoy Univers, I think was the full title of it, near Basel railway station. Of course, it had no real sign saying, you know, this is the Bank for International Settlements. You got in there through a little doorway next to a chocolate shop. No, the feeling was if you needed to know where the bank was, you would know where it was. And if you didn't, then you certainly had no business looking for it. You know, Switzerland was the obvious choice in a way, really. There was some talk of putting it in Amsterdam or London or Brussels. But, you know, Switzerland is neutral and it had a very strong tradition of banking and banking secrecy. So that seemed to be the kind of logical place to put it. It stayed in Basel. It moved not very far away to its new address, which is at Central Bahnplatz 2. It's a very strange 18-story circular building with tinted windows that overlooks a very busy road on one side and overlooks the train station on the other side. And it's got all the flags out of its member nations, like a kind of mini United Nations. And that's why I call it the Tower of Basel, because it is a tower and it's in Basel. And when you go inside, there's very high security. You have to go through all these double doors and, you know, get passed in and everything like that. It was built in the 1970s. It's got this really strange 1970s feel. It's sort of globular furniture and these looping circular corridors. It's got this sort of slightly Goldfinger-y James Bond feel to it. It's a very interesting building in a way, it's architecturally.
How much time did you actually get to spend there?
Well, I spent some time, quite a while in the archives. A week I spent in the archives. But, you know, when you're in there, it's very tightly controlled. I mean, give them credit, the archives are open to all legitimate researchers under the 30-year rule, which means that the documents up until 30 years ago are open, unless there are things like, you know, personnel files or something like that, which is confidential. But a lot of the bank's history and records and what it's done is all there, and they were very helpful to me. But, you know, it's funny, you go in and you sit in the archive room and you put your requests in and the files come up. You're escorted everywhere. You're allowed to go to the toilet on your own or to get a drink of water. I mean, look, the place is blanketed in CCTV cameras anyway. So, you know, when I went to the library, you're escorted to the library. You want to leave the library, you must be called and someone will come and get you. And, of course, the journalist in me wanted to kind of just ride the lifts up and down, and especially on the last day, and see what would happen. But then, you know, I didn't do that because I wouldn't be responsible, because the archivist was nice and helpful. So I wanted to be respectful in that sense. But, of course, you know, you're very curious. What's going on these other floors.
Now, although you're allowed to go through the archives, you've noted that there aren't really minutes for the meetings.
The meetings that take place over the weekend, no, there's no minutes taken of those. The only minutes that are taken are the board of directors, which is stuff to do with the bank governance, like, I don't know, things to do with personnel and the admin of the bank. Obviously, minutes are taken of those.
Let's talk about some sort of concrete examples of what this bank has actually managed to do post-World War II. You gave some concrete examples. One was in the 1960s on the London Gold Pool. What exactly happened?
One of the main things about the Bank for International Settlements is that it's a meeting place, and it's a protected meeting place where nobody has any authority there. It's extraterritorial, so the bankers feel that they can really sit and take some decisions there and have very in-depth discussions without having to be accountable to anybody. So the London Gold Pool was a means by which the different central banks, you know, just agreed a series of maneuvers to keep the price of gold at $35 an ounce. And you could say, you know, that's what was set out at Bretton Woods, which was a democratic meeting of the Allied powers. So they were just maneuvering the markets in that sense to keep the price stable. But what was very interesting was the bank's role behind the scenes in constructing the euro. The preparations for the euro started in the late 1940s, essentially, because you can't just slam all these currencies like the lira and the franc and the Deutschmark together. You have to stabilize them and reduce the exchange rate fluctuations and keep them in exchange rate bands and try and hold those bands. And all of this was done at the BIS in very obscure things that most people have never heard of, like the European Payments Union and the European Monetary Cooperation Fund, and the Governors Committee meetings were held there, the Committee of the Governors of the European Central Banks. And then crucially, in the late 1980s, the Delors Committee, which laid out the serious plan for European Monetary Union and the euro, met at the BIS, you know, and it wasn't part of the BIS, but it physically met there. It was serviced by the BIS, and one of its most important members was a man called Alexandre Lamfalussy, who was the general manager of the BIS, and he's known as the father of the euro because basically he was one of the few people that understood what was needed to get this single European currency together. So the BIS has been absolutely integral to the whole euro project.
Do you think that they have done other things that has made them responsible in part for what has happened in Europe?
The bank certainly bears a measure of responsibility for the eurozone crisis because the euro was, the banks played an essential scene behind the scenes for the idea of this project that you can bring a single European currency to Europe. You know, it hosted, it ran the European Monetary Union, it ran the European Exchange, it ran the European Monetary Cooperation Fund. It's been there all the time, and Alexandre Lamfalussy is known as the father of the euro. But I'll give him credit because he did actually say that I have severe doubts about this currency because you can't have a transnational currency without transnational fiscal policy, which means that you can't have countries sharing the same currency with wildly different policies on tax and public spending and taxation, as, of course, you know, we've seen with Germany and Greece. But, you know, he was a good soldier and said, okay, if that's what the politicians want. The euro was imposed by politicians, not by the BIS, but the BIS did very much of the work so the politicians could do that.
You've also suggested that this bank has had a role in whether or not certain countries have to deal with austerity measures. They actually have an effect on countries' economies.
They don't have power, but they're very influential. The fact that the bankers all meet there every 2 months gives them an influence. And their annual reports come out every year, and they're very dense and detailed and extremely professional, read in finance ministries and commercial banks around the world. And to give them credit, they're publicly available. Anyone can go and download them. But the bank, through the decades, has always been very careful on the side of stopping too much inflation and stopping too much lending, and leans very much towards that. It's part of the bank's heritage. You've got to say that they called out the global crisis 2 or 3 years before everybody else. They said, look, there's too much money sloshing around here and it's not being controlled and it's all going to go horribly wrong. But at the same time, No, the counter-argument is, well, it's up to governments, really, to run economies. It's not really for a bank of unelected technocrats, you know, sitting there in Basel with its super layer of privileges and unaccountability to start telling countries what to do and to have austerity and to behave in a certain way. So, you know, there's a tension there.
A tension there, meaning?
You know, the tension there between, well, who are you exactly, the BIS, you know, this unaccountable, super-protected, supranational organization to start issuing policy prescriptions to democratically elected governments?
So it isn't as if there is any kind of real power, per se. It's a different kind of influence.
Yeah, it's an influence. I mean, they're not issuing decisions and saying you've got to do this. But, you know, it's where influence shades into power by the virtue of its existence and its prestige. I mean, the other important thing about the BIS is that it hosts and is connected to extremely important parts of the new global financial architecture. Specifically, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision is hosted at the BIS. And that's the committee that says commercial banks, not central banks, must have 8% of risk-weighted assets. If you're lending out $100 million, you've got to have access to $8 million in case it goes wrong to prevent bank crashes. Now, all of that's done at the bank. It's rather like the euro. The BIS didn't impose the euro and can't impose the 8% rule. But the 8% rule, everyone sticks to it, because if you're an international bank and you want to do business internationally, you must adhere to what's called the Basel criteria. And now the BIS hosts the Financial Stability Board, which coordinates the national central banks and monetary authorities and the regulatory authorities. So it's right there in the center all the time. And the fact of it being in the center, it gives it enormous prestige and influence.
And what do you see as the future of this bank?
They're going to have to democratize it and make it more accountable. Because this is a bank, you know, that was founded in 1930. It really of a vanished age of deference to authority. And it just doesn't work anymore that it's so secretive and difficult to deal with. They're not very forthcoming to journalists who are asking questions about governance and how it works. For example, they have a Twitter feed, but what's on the Twitter feed is mostly links to speeches of central bankers, you know, stuff that's already in the public domain. You know, they're not putting out tweets saying, you know, the central bankers met here and the broad themes of discussion were this and that and the other. So they're going to have to change that. And what I suggest in my book, you know, this is a very profitable institution. It's only got 140 customers, but it made more than $1 billion tax-free. All its profits are tax-free, and all the people that work there get tax-free salaries as well. I mean, the general manager gets around 800,000 euros a year tax-free. I mean, there's incredible sums of money for a public institution. And so I say that they should issue a tranche of shares to civil society somehow, set up a foundation, maybe like the Open Society Institute, and bring in, you know, young business people and bankers from around the world, give them some shares so they have a voice at the annual general meeting, distribute some of the profits to do some socially responsible philanthropic ventures. They wouldn't tell me how much money they give away, but they said most of their philanthropy is like local things in Basel, like supporting, you know, Basel initiatives. So, I mean, that's not really good enough. This is a global bank that makes a lot of money. And it makes the money out of central banks, which are public money. So we need more accountability here.
It strikes me that one of the primary influences is this continuation of a particular ideology about how the economies should work.
Since its founding, the BIS has always emphasized prudence and the need for controlling inflation. And that's partly because it's a bank of central banks. I mean, any central banker will tell you that you can't play with inflation. I mean, the anti-austerians say that we need a little bit of inflation to kind of boost the economy and get the money flowing again. And central bankers say, no, we're not having any inflation, ideally, because inflation eats away at the value of people's money. So there's always been that argument. But the bank has been very influential. You know, even the IMF now is told George Osborne, the British Chancellor, that, you know, really, you've got to stop with this austerity now. But the bank has always been on the side of austerity.
Adam Labora, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Again, the book is called Tower of Basel, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World. When we come back, how comedy and humor impact everything from our health to our societies. Stay tuned.
personally, I think healthcare should be free for all Americans. That's just my opinion. Yeah. For you guys who didn't clap, that means you can't relate. Let me tell you something. It's messed up when you're too broke to go to the doctors. You know you should be at the doctors, but instead you in CVS at 2 o'clock in the morning trying to diagnose yourself. You be walking in like, oh, shit. My kidneys are messed up. I better get me some NyQuil. I heard NyQuil is good for bad kidneys. Let me get some Tums for this tumor I got, too. You know, Tums is in the word tumors.
That was award-winning comic actor Reuben Paul. This is The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Humor affects many things: our health, our disposition, our relationships, and our organizations. Can it also help to change politics and society? With us are three experts. Amber Day is a professor of performance studies in the English and Cultural Studies Department at Bryant University. She's the author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate, and Breaking Boundaries in Politics and Political Entertainment Studies. John Morrill is professor of philosophy and department chair of religious studies at William & Mary College. He is the founder of International Society for Humor Studies and the author of Comic Relief, A Comprehensive Philosophy of Humor, and The Philosophy of Laughter and Humor. Peter McGraw also joins us. Peter McGraw is a professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He directs the Humor Research Lab and co-directs the Moral Research Lab. He's the author of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you. John Morrill, I'd like to start with you for a historic context. You've traced the origin of humor historically. You've looked at it even in animals. What does history tell us about humor?
Well, the current best theory, I think, of the evolution of humor is that it evolved from a rough-and-tumble kind of play in apes. Gorillas and chimpanzees, from whom we split in evolution about 6 million years ago, have a kind of laughter that's kind of hard to pick up because it's on the intake rather than the outtake. So instead of laughing ha-ha-ha, they laugh ah-ah-ah. It's kind of like panting. And what it accompanies is mock wrestling, chasing and biting, the kind of things that you do with a little kid. And just as with a little child, when chimps and gorillas chase each other and wrestle each other to the ground and pretend that they're aggressive, they give a signal that they're only playing, and that signal is laughter. So for me, the best theory of the evolution of laughter and humor is that they came from a kind of rough-and-tumble play where it was necessary that they signal to the other person, look, I'm not out to hurt you. I'm not out to break your skin when I pretend to bite you, for example. And that laughter was this play signal. You can see this today when somebody tries to be funny, but they don't give any indication that you're trying to be funny. Well, what that usually ends up in is being threatening. The great example of that was Andy Kaufman, who for years after he left Saturday Night Live went around the country challenging women to wrestle him and defeat him, but he didn't put it in any kind of play frame. He didn't give any comedic hints that he was only playing. So he would show up these wrestling places, and he'd have women who really took him seriously and really wanted to hurt him. So when we are playing and when we want to engage in humor, we need laughter to signal that we're only playing.
Peter McGraw.
So what John says is, I think, is absolutely right, that the origin of humor started with play, but as humans developed and started to have other sorts of rules, new linguistic rules and cultural rules and societal rules, the things that became threatening or that could become wrong started to expand. And so the things that we find funny now have moved beyond the physical. Now it can be toilet humor, things like puns, moving outside of that, satire, irony, sarcasm, and so on. And the work that we've been doing in the Humor Research Lab has identified an explanation for that, something that we call benign violations, that we tend to laugh at, we are delighted by, amused by situations that seem both wrong and okay, in the same way that rough and tumble play is playful and fun when it's both a violation, there's some threat, and then also some idea of, oh, this is okay, this is safe, this is playful. And so this evolution has moved up and branched out and has created what is really a complex yet exciting topic of research.
Amber Day, in your introduction, you look at various kinds of satire. And one of the things that you noted in your, I think it was in the literature review, was that it used to be really the art of the aristocrats, but now it's like a tool for the populist.
So that's how it sort of grossly gets characterized. I don't know that that's entirely true across the board. I think there was, for a long time, literary scholars considered it a conservative art form because it was used in that way. I think there's certainly examples that go against that grain. But there's definitely, you know, there's power in humor, and I think it can be used in either direction. So you can use it certainly to sort of put people in their place and remind them of the status quo and that they're stepping outside of it and using it for ridicule, and that tends to be from top down. But you can certainly also use it to question and to deconstruct the official line and, you know, to point out ironies, and that tends to be more of a sort of subversive bottom up.
Ironies, absurdities, but then, yes, you know, the idea of laughing at rather than laughing with.
Is certainly different than the sort of evolutionary start of it, in a way.
When we talk about laughing at versus laughing with, Peter McGraw, I think you were the one who wrote the piece on partisanship and humor. First of all, it sounded like the left won the humor quotient, hands down, but they have different preferences for humor. Conservatives like one kind of humor and liberals like another. Can you break that down for us?
Certainly. The intuition is that the Democrats are the funny party. But I think to Amber's point, a lot of that is the sort of laughing at, the attacking the traditions and attacking those people in power. But when it comes to being funny, more generally, liberals and conservatives seem to be more equal. It's not clear that there's good evidence that liberals are funnier people. And some work done by Dan Ariely reveals that. That in some ways, depending on the topic, conservatives really have a much better time. I think that follows what we tend to find, this idea that benign violations is subjective. It depends on your values and your beliefs and your experiences. So what's funny to one person is not funny to another. And as a result, in some sense, everybody's funny. Everybody has equal opportunity to be funny, whether or not they're a liberal or a conservative.
And then, of course, there's just the infectiousness of Joe Biden laughing the entire time during his vice presidential debate with Paul Ryan.
Indeed. Yeah, and that's certainly a case where he was using laughter as ridicule.
So in this case, you think he was laughing at Paul Ryan?
Well, I think that he was using laughter to point out the ridiculousness, the absurdities of the things that Ryan was saying, and in a way that was designed to kind of resonate with his party.
John Morrell, let's bring you back in here. Now, you've looked at this philosophically, and you say that we really value comic characters more than other types of heroes, like the tragic hero. First of all, tell us why that is, and then walk us through the Barack Obama kind of comic role.
Sure. One of the things that I've studied is the contrast between the heroic tradition, which lasted in American politics well into the 20th century. People like, well, take a turn of the century president like William Howard Taft or even the early Teddy Roosevelt. These people were frequently military veterans, or Eisenhower would be an even better example. These are people who were often military veterans, and they were part of a long tradition that goes back to the ancient Greeks, where the leader is somebody who tries to maximize power. They try to maximize their own knowledge. They try to be on top of everything. And they typically don't laugh very much at themselves. There's a newer style of leadership, which has grown up in the U.S. and throughout the world in the last 30 years or so, which I call post-heroic. And in this style of leadership, you don't emphasize the difference between you and the people you govern. In corporations, for example, in the last 30 years, they've leveled the pyramid. That is, that they've cut out a lot of the levels of organization. And so you see CEOs talking to ordinary people on the manufacturing line. The newer style of leadership tends to have a lot more humor in it. When I do talks like this for political groups and business groups, I often use William Howard Taft, who was not only a very kind of a stuffy president, but he was also our nation's fattest president. On the day of his inauguration, he weighed something over 300 pounds, and there was a new bathtub in the White House. And he got stuck in the tub, and it took four guys over 2 hours to extricate him from the tub. But he swore everybody to secrecy because he wouldn't want the population of the U.S. laughing at him. If you contrast that with somebody like Barack Obama, Obama isn't the funniest guy in the world, but he can certainly poke fun at himself. One of my favorite examples was between the time he was elected and his inauguration. He was in a press conference, and they were throwing him all kinds of tough questions about the economy, which was in a shambles, and all kinds of stuff. And finally, somebody threw him a softball question, and they said, "We hear that you're going to get a dog for the White House for your daughters. What kind of dog are you going to get?" And Obama said, "Well, at first we thought we wanted to get a mutt." And then he said, "Like me." And to me, that was just a watershed moment for a president to say a mutt and then like me, because he's half black, he's half white. It showed a guy who could poke fun at himself. And that kind of leadership is found not just in politics, but also in business. If you look at CEOs today, for example, versus, say, 50 years ago, they've removed the tie. A lot of them have also removed the sport jacket or the suit jacket. And the hero of this movement is Herb Kelleher of Southwest Airlines, who's built a very successful corporation, largely on his playfulness, his sense of humor, and his ability to link both of those to spirit of camaraderie and equality. Humor tends to level differences between people. So when a president or a CEO or your boss can engage in really open humor, I'm not talking about sarcasm or put down, but really open humor, everybody can relax and social relations go a lot better.
Amber Day, this is a perfect place to bring you in because you've looked at this as a form of dissent also, and you've studied all kinds of political dissent, whether it was satire or some other kinds of activism. How do you see this now shaping the political landscape with the new satirists in town?
Sure. I found that last point really interesting, and I kind of want to jump off of it because I feel like it's not just in leadership, but it's become more of a cultural norm to sort of to use a kind of self-deprecating or self-referential irony. And that in many circles, that somehow kind of signals an honesty or a trustworthiness. I think that's partially because of the way in which political discourse, in particular the sort of public debate, is so kind of stage managed, so perfect, so you know, shiny and fake in many ways, right? We all know the way it's staged, and yet there's this frustration in the way in which the press isn't doing the best job of getting through that, you know, getting past the talking points that have been pre-scripted and all of that. And so I think where a lot of the sort of interesting political satire is coming out these days and the hunger for it is this desire to see somebody actually kind of poke holes in that spectacle and do so in a way in which they're not necessarily an expert, but they're also kind of drawing attention to who they are and that they don't claim to be perfect and that they don't necessarily have all the answers. So there's a sort of humble irony employed there.
And you've noted that this has actually transformed at least some of our comics, our comedians, into really legitimate pundits, or at least semi-legitimate pundits.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, a figure like, you know, Jon Stewart, of course, is the first one to come to mind, is quite different than what's come before. A few decades ago, Chevy Chase was everybody really liked his impression of the presidents and they liked his Weekend Update shtick, but you would never ask Chevy Chase seriously for his take on contemporary politics. Nobody would think of doing so, but Jon Stewart is doing something quite different than what Chevy Chase was doing.
Right, and Jon Stewart happens to be quite learned and well-read and brilliant at the same time, which perhaps is what makes a great comic.
I think so. Well, you can be funny in many different ways, but the way in which he's funny and the things that resonate are because he is really sort of revealing things, pulling back the curtain on some of that political debate and some of the staged nature of political discourse and really letting us watch how it's put together in a way that's incredibly satisfying, I think.
Peter McGraw, that sort of touches on something that was in one of your blogs, which deals with the humor being sort of counter-establishment by its nature. And how do you see that fitting in with today's politics?
You know, one of the roots of sort of stand-up comedy is entertainment, comes out of the motif of the trickster, of the court jester. And on my Humor Code travels, my co-author Joel Warner and I met with Patch Adams. And I can't repeat the language that Patch used, but he basically said that the court jester is the only person who can call the king a jack, you know. And so he actually used more flavorful language than that. And that tradition continues today, where comedians, stand-up or otherwise, are taking aim at the things that are wrong with the traditions, with the people in power, with government, with media. And the Jon Stewarts of the world, they happen to be doing it, you know, better than anyone else, in part because Jon Stewart is really adept. He's quick on his feet. He's a quick thinker. He also has a writer's room full of very funny Harvard graduates who are helping him out along the way. And the very best comedians that we've found on the road are ones that can take aim at themselves, as John and Amber mentioned, in part to increase that level of credibility, that if they can make fun of themselves, then they certainly can make fun of all these other things that are wrong in the world.
John Morrell, let's bring you back in then. You've talked about the benefits of humor. It helps us individually. You've talked about various ways it helps organizations. How do you think it's beneficial for politics of the world?
It's interesting that the beginning of comedy was in the 5th century BCE in Athens, Greece, and the beginning of democracy was in 5th century Athens, Greece, 5th century BCE. I think that there's a very strong link between people being able to joke about their leaders, to poke fun at their shortcomings, their hypocrisy, their screw-ups, etc., and their political freedom. So I think that there's a strong link between open societies and democratic values and this ability to have people like Jon Stewart around. If you look at countries that are repressive, if you look, for example, at several countries in the Middle East, where joking about the leader can get you executed, you see the opposite of this. And in the West, probably the strongest example of somebody who repressed humor was Hitler. When Hitler was rising to power in the late 20s and early 30s, the first people who criticized him were stand-up comedians. At that time, they were called cabaret comics. And when Hitler came to power in 1933, one of the first things that he did was establish special courts for prosecuting people who made fun of his Third Reich or made fun of the brown shirts or made fun of the way the Nazis were told to march, etc. And over 100 people were executed. One stand-up comic in Berlin, for example, was executed. He was hanged for naming his horse Adolf. If you look at the Soviet Union, there was a similar pattern. The Soviet Union wanted to control humor and suppress humor that was critical of the leader. And they even set up a special journal, which came out every 10 days in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, it had a larger circulation than Time magazine and Newsweek magazine put together in this country, and it was called Crocodile. And what they allowed humor about was inefficiency, bureaucratic red tape, people being drunk on the job, people not doing their work. But what they didn't allow was jokes about the leadership. So the secretary of the Communist Party was never a legitimate target. So governments have known since the days of ancient Egypt, when the first court jesters were in place, that humor is powerful, and humor may be playful, but it can be playfully critical. And so governments that are more open allow for more humor. Governments that are more controlled and repressive are afraid of humor.
Amber Day, I don't recall if you actually had this in your literature or in your book, but can you tell us what kind of a measurable impact some of these new, what you called Renaissance comics, are making in society in America today or in the other countries that you looked at?
The short answer is no, but I think, yes, the problem is sort of how do you measure that effect, and that's the hardest thing to do, right? And I think we tend to sort of look at it very simplistically and say, well, is this one piece going to have a measurable effect on the next election? And the answer is usually no, of course it isn't. But I think these comics and, you know, a number of the filmmakers, the activists that I'm looking at are making a difference and they are doing something. But I think it's smaller. I think it's shifting the conversation in small ways, changing the terms in which we talk about particular issues, or even actually pushing issues that were very peripheral and only sort of talked about in marginal counterpublics, pushing those further into the wider public sphere and into the wider discussion. And I think that's huge. And that's the kind of thing, these shifts have to happen before change ever takes place, right? Because sort of public perception has to change, but it is the stuff that's incredibly hard to actually track and measure.
We do know from the, I think it's the Pew studies, that The Daily Show was certainly the leading source of news, political news for young people, particularly through the election periods.
Right.
Perhaps we should take a little shift and talk about, well, what makes things funny? And this is something that you've all looked at as well. Peter McGraw, that's kind of the whole subject of your institute. Why don't you start us with this? Why are some things funny and some things not?
So, yeah, so I recognize that some of my theorizing isn't always popular as a kind of outsider moving into this field. My expertise is in judgment and decision-making and the study of emotion more generally. And when I stumbled on this question, I surveyed the research, including John's work, and found hints at different perspectives, one that's different than the traditional view of humor arising from some form of incongruity, that there's some mismatch between what we expect and what we get in the world. And as I mentioned earlier, I, based on my reading, came to the conclusion that actually humor has a counterintuitive underpinning, that of something negative, what we call a violation. And luckily, there's support for this by people a lot smarter than me. Mark Twain has a great quote where he says that the secret source of humor is not joy, it's sorrow. There is no humor in heaven. That is because because heaven's perfect. There's nothing actually to laugh at. And the studies that we've been doing in the Humor Research Lab seems to help support that idea. But of course, the things that are violations don't normally amuse us. They upset us. And so you have to have this other judgment, this recognition that the situation is safe or acceptable or okay, or as we say, benign.
So then it really could collapse into the tragic.
So the tragic is actually a really good source of humor in many ways, but it also keeps with a saying that's at least been attributed to Mark Twain, that the humor is tragedy plus time, that as time passes, as you get some distance from the thing that's bad, it helps transform it from a violation into a benign violation.
And John Morrell, would you agree?
Yes. Peter's notion of a benign violation fits fairly well with the traditional theory called the incongruity theory, which says that in a humorous situation, something violates your expectations. You expect A and you get not A, or even better, you get the opposite of A. So your expectations are violated. That's part one. And part two is you don't go into a negative emotion. You don't get scared. You don't become sad or depressed. You're not disgusted or angry. Instead, you are able to enjoy the incongruity. You're able to enjoy this surprise. Humans are the only ones who can pull this off. You can surprise your cat, for example, by moving her food dish to a different spot in the kitchen. You can dress up in a funny Halloween costume in front of your dog, but you'll never get a laugh out of either one of them. So humans are the only ones who can experience something that they weren't ready for, even the opposite of what they were ready for, and even including their own disappointments and their own mistakes, and somehow enjoy it. They can have their mental train derailed and enjoy the train wreck. So Peter's notion of a violation, which is safe or okay or benign, I think it works very well. And you notice that in some situations, the same event which surprises, say, a room full of people, will make some of them angry and others of them amused. So I think there's a personal difference between people who go into a negative emotion versus people who go into laughter instead. And that's basically what Peter referred to quickly as distance. I call it mental distance. People who can laugh about things typically see it from a higher perspective. They step back. They're less emotionally engaged. People who tend to experience everything with anger or fear or sadness or depression tend to be emotionally wrapped up in things. And that's the heart of tragedy. The difference between tragedy and comedy isn't the subject matter. In comedy and in tragedy, the subject matter is disappointment and failure and suffering and death and our inability to understand what's happening to us. Comedy isn't about happy, successful people doing well. It's about the same thing tragedy is about. But the tragic character goes into her emotions. She gets swept away by them. The comic character steps back and thinks her way rather than feels her way through her problems.
Amber Day.
I would just add to that a little bit, but I don't think we should see comedy, humor, irony as completely removed from the serious or the feeling or, you know, feeling very strongly about something. Because there tends to be this assumption that, you know, somebody like Jon Stewart, well, it's bad for politics, right? It's cynical. And, you know, we're just laughing at it. We're not really caring about it. And I spend a lot of time sort of pushing against that assumption because I think what's really interesting about a lot of the political humor in particular that we see right now is a lot of it is actually very earnest, you know, and it's being used to rile us up to some degree, particularly in some of the activist groups that I take a look at, or some of the viral videos that we see circulating before an election. They tend to use irony and humor and satire to get our attention and to grab us. And I think there is that aspect of the benign violation because the satisfaction comes in knowing, wow, somebody else notices this, right? Somebody else is seeing this. And that makes me feel a little bit better. But I think the intended effect, a lot of the time, if it is being used to garner attention or to actively get people involved in something, is to get them mad, really, or to get them upset about it and feel like there are other people who are laughing at the same thing and who are upset about the same thing and that there's sort of that strength in numbers.
Thank you, all three of you, for joining us. John Morrell, Amber Day, Peter McGraw, it's great to have you here with us on the Scholar Circle. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Amber Day is a professor of performance studies in the English and Cultural Studies Department at Bryant University. She's the author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate, and Breaking Boundaries in Politics and Political Entertainment Studies. John Morrell is professor of philosophy and department chair of religious studies at William & Mary College. He is the founder of International Society for Humor Studies and the author of Comic Relief, A Comprehensive Philosophy of Humor, and The Philosophy of Laughter and Humor. Peter McGraw is a professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He directs the Humor Research Lab and co-directs the Moral Research Lab. He's the author of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, and Cuauhtemoc Gailaman. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.